You're listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.
A pathway to a possible deal. With 20 days to go before Britain is set to leave the EU, that was the assessment of both the Taoiseach and the British Prime Minister after spending several hours together in the northwest of England. The European Union's chief Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier and the British Brexit Secretary Stephen Barclay are meeting in Brussels this morning to assess if there's a basis to start negotiations. The primary difficulty remains the border left behind on this island after Brexit. Speaking on the BBC's The View last night, Britain's Northern Secretary Julian Smith said that both leaders appear to find common ground in the talks yesterday.
My relationship with the Irish government has been really positive since I became Secretary, and I was just delighted to see the positivity that came out of the Cheshire meeting. In terms of the details, as you know, we've got a number of key areas, the issue of consent, the issue of customs, and a number of other areas that are being looked at. I'm not going to go into the detail of that now, but I think that the mood music and the developments for today are really, really positive developments.
Julian Smith went on to say that no one community in the North will have a veto over any proposed deal.
I'm not going to go into detail on the negotiation, but what I can tell you it doesn't mean is a veto for one community over any element of this.
So some kind of Northern Ireland-only referendum would be a way of dealing with
there
that, wouldn't it?
There are a whole range of options.
Well, that's the main thing
is that we have to have regard to the Good Friday Agreement and have regard for the need to have a cross-community approach to how we resolve this.
And that's how you would resolve it. So we are looking at a Northern Ireland-only referendum, are we?
No, I didn't say that. I said that there will not be a situation where one community has a veto over this.
That was Mark Carruthers speaking with Julian Smith, Britain's Northern Secretary, on the BBC's The View last night. Let's speak to our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman. Morning, Tommy.
Morning, Gavin.
Has something changed?
Oh, big time. I wrote a piece for our website last night where I suggested that Leo Varadkar had entered a casino. He got off the fence yesterday. He moved to centre stage. He took an initiative. It was very, very deliberate. Let's just chart what exactly went on. He brought across to Liverpool his trusted team, the likes of Martin Fraser, Sec General to the government, Brian Murphy, John Callanan, Helen Blake. And Boris Johnson did the very same. He had a cabinet secretary who was in Dundalk 2 weeks ago, Sir Mark Sedwell, who was given a tour of the border at the time by Peter Sheridan from Cooperation Ireland. There too he had John Bew, son of Paul Bew, Lord Bew, born in Cork, former advisor to David Trimble. John Bew is a very able historian and he's a key member of the Boris Johnson team. There as well in the background, Dominic Cummings, another person there, Chief of Staff Sir Ed Lister. They spoke for 3 hours. Most of the discussions were a one-on-one, Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar. Now, okay, we all know the Amber Rudd story. You go to a party with Boris Johnson, but would you go home with him? There are risks in getting involved in one-on-one negotiations with Boris Johnson. But Leo Varadkar knew exactly what he was doing. And not just did he allow himself to be photographed, not just did he sign up to a joint statement where he talked about a possible pathway to a deal. He then went into a news conference, quite deliberately. And Leo Varadkar, he doesn't do things instinctively. You know, he thinks about things very, very hard to read, completely different to a lot of former Taoiseach. But in that news conference, he actually talked about dates. He talked about getting a deal in place by the 31st of October. Those were not the actions of a man who had not thought out his position. So he has made that commitment. And the first few things to watch to see how things are running. Look at what happened to the pound overnight. It strengthened, amazingly. The next big test, because it's all very well for the Irish and the British, for Leo Varadkar to get off the fence, for them to take an initiative because of Ireland being so caught up in the whole Brexit drama. But the next big test is this morning. Stephen Barclay, rough around the edges, you know, not very experienced. But Michel Barnier, who has seen characters come and go, who's almost fed up with the British posturing at times. So Barnier will be, I suppose, a very, very tough test this morning. But if you see a decision from those two men this morning that they will move to the next stage of going into the tunnel and maintain the confidentiality, then there is something very, very different happening. This is significant, Gavin.
Leo Varadkar gave a news conference yesterday which was striking in its positivity. As George Parker was telling us from London earlier, there's been very little reaction from London. What about reaction in Belfast? Have the DUP said anything?
Yeah, let's take those George Parker comments. It's significant that they've managed to keep the lid on this in London. Like, given that Dominic Cummings was there in Liverpool yesterday and there hasn't been that much spinning going on, that suggests a step change. And you're 100% on the money when you say, what's the reaction in Belfast? Look who the key person they put out last night was, and look at the comments he made. Julian Smith. This is a different kind of Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. He's been really, really impressive. He's put himself out there. He has a very good relationship already with Simon Coveney. So what did he say last night? First of all, he said that in terms of consent, it couldn't just be one community having a veto. He talked about the need for cross-community support. And that chimes directly with the word Arlene Foster used in recent times, collegiality. But here's where it gets really, really interesting. If this is to work, and it's still an outside chance of it working, Stormont is going to be essential. And that's a working Stormont, not the Stormont that has been closed, because the two main players north of the border at the moment, Sinn Féin and the DUP, are on gardening leave, very long gardening leave. So if there is to be pain in this for the DUP, there has to be gain as well. Arlene Foster is a devolutionist. You have to get Stormont back up and running for it to have an ongoing meaningful role. And significantly too, a person who becomes key in southern politics is Mary Lou MacDonald, because Sinn Féin will continue with its abstentionist policy in Westminster, but Sinn Féin will get back into Stormont, back into power sharing if this works. So that's where Mary Lou MacDonald becomes part of this jigsaw. It's fascinating, Gavin.
Julian Smith, when asked, as we heard there by Mark Carruthers, he didn't rule out a Northern Ireland referendum or deny that it was on the table.
Yeah, and remember, say, how Leo Varadkar dealt with that question in recent times. And I heard Eamon Ryan of the Green Party referring to that kind of a concept yesterday. There's a bit of a danger attached to that, Gavin, that if you did have a referendum at the moment in Northern Ireland, might some see it as a border poll? Might it just raise tensions? If it was being conducted in an atmosphere where people were getting back into power sharing again and they were willing to move into a new space of live and let live, which is ultimately going to be the solution to this, then say a referendum would be fine. But if it was going to be a divisive referendum, orange versus green, how big is your tribe, how big is our tribe, well then it would be fraught with danger. So it would depend on the circumstances in which a referendum would be held. And I think that was the significance of, I suppose, the reluctance of Julian Smith last night to actually commit himself to the concept of a referendum, full stop.
Tommy, thank you. That's our Northern editor, Tommy Gorman.
In Washington, there's one impeachment inquiry, but now two whistleblowers who've come forward to complain about President Donald Trump's interactions with Ukraine. U.S. Democrats opened a formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump over concerns that he asked the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to launch a corruption investigation into Joe Biden, who is one of the frontrunners to become a presidential candidate next year. Speaking yesterday, Joe Biden called President Trump a bully and a coward.
This is a president trying to get two of our most serious competitors and not allies to decide this election, decide who he runs against. This guy, like all bullies, is a coward. He does not want to run against me. That's what this is about.
That's Joe Biden speaking yesterday. We're joined on the line now by Bob Schmuel, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Schmuel, good morning and thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
The emergence of this second whistleblower, this is significant because this is someone with first-hand knowledge of this phone call back in July. The first whistleblower was not on the call and only had second-hand knowledge of it.
Yes, and President Trump made a big deal out of that in his speeches, remarks to journalists, and also on Twitter. at the very end of September, he referred to the fake whistleblower complaint is not holding up because it is a fraud. So that there was an attempt by the people who knew as much as they could about the call to rally around. And they're talking about a number of whistleblowers or potential whistleblowers. And I think basically what we're seeing is greater strength in numbers to try to make this case.
President Trump says there's nothing in all of this. He's argued that it was his right to ask for an investigation, but he's never actually offered any evidence as to why there should be an investigation at all against the Bidens, has he?
No, and if you read the rough transcript of the conversation, you see the movement from the president of Ukraine talking about military armament, and then the president talking about the possibility of a favor that would be granted. It started there, and then last week he changed course and talked about, well, all I was interested in was investigating corruption because that's my job. So it's moved rather quickly from being something that one could rather easily identify as politically related to this larger view to corruption in general. And what's interesting is last week he invited the Chinese to look into the Bidens, and immediately the people who were supporting him, who are supporting him, went on the television airways and said, oh, well, that was just a joke. He was just kidding about that. So that we're in this very murky shadow land of discussion related to this impeachment.
Yes, and you heard Joe Biden there in that clip coming out fighting yesterday. But he has shown a reluctance in the past to discuss anything related to his family in public. And he has been slow enough to respond to President Trump's attacks. Are there concerns among Democrats that maybe he's not up to the job if he can't forcibly defend himself against President Trump's attacks?
Yes, and I think one has to admit or at least point out that there are certain optical problems with his son being an advisor to Ukraine in an area that he was not all that familiar with. So that I think one points that out, and I think it's something that would dog the Biden trail throughout the campaign. But the other thing that I might say is that Joe Biden has been reluctant because he and others don't really want to get down in the mud with Donald Trump this early. Last month, Donald Trump tweeted 800 times. It was a record for him, and it looks as though he'll break that record in this month of October. He's obsessed with this story and its relation to his future, but also to the campaign that's coming up. And I think that Democrats are wondering exactly how far do you push him at this time when you have over a full year ahead of you.
Yes, I think it's called poking the crazy bear, isn't it? Bob Shmuel.
I think that's the technical term.
Bob Shmuel, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Thank you very much for staying up to talk to us this morning.
The Waterford Greenway, the Western Greenway, those cycling routes along some of our most beautiful scenic pathways. They're trying to develop something similar in Kerry, but it's running into problems. The first day of an oral hearing will start today. We can talk to Kerry-based journalist Anne Lucy. Anne, where's the biggest objection coming from?
From farmers mainly and landowners along that what is a 30 or what will be or maybe a 32 kilometre route between Glynbe and Rinard, which is at the sea beyond Carhartt-Savine, mainly from farmers and landowners. There's a few 40 individual objectors, and you have a total of 197 landowners, and their objections are twofold. One, they object to a compulsory purchase order. And secondly, they also have concerns about the design of the route in places. It is mainly, though not exclusively, along an abandoned, if you like, railway that was not sort of taken into ownership by the rail company, but was either given, sold, or taken over by adjoining landowners. So what you're talking about is 222 pieces of land, and they measure between tiny, 0.001 hectare to over 0.2 hectares.
Okay, so the council want a compulsory purchase land and then the route. Do the farmers want it somewhere else? Presumably they see the benefits of a greenway.
Yes, they do. In fact, everybody is quite behind it, and it is a greenway paved with good intentions, but it just hasn't got off the ground since it was announced. It was the flagship project for the Department of Transport in 2014 in the run-up to the local elections, but it has stalled. And it has stalled principally because of issues with design, with landowners who want, perhaps rather than having to open two or three gates, they want into their lands, they want the council to go a slightly different route in parts. Now, the other thing that is hugely contentious is the compulsory purchase order. And you have the IFA nationally involved. They had a protest last year outside the council offices in Tralee. They fear that the use of the CPO for a leisureway, such as a greenway, will lead to similar cases all over the country by county councils, and they say that should be reserved for major infrastructure such as roads and housing and ports and gas lines and what have you.
Okay, so what do the councils say, Anne?
Well, the council see this is a key economic driver, and most people support them on it, but they're saying that they are obliged to use the CPO when they don't get all land owners agreeable to selling their parcels of land to them. So they're saying they have to use the CPO for everybody. So it is a highly contentious thing. It will go on for probably right into the end of next week.
This oral hearing, it starts today.
It starts today, where the council will outline their case, and then later in the week you will have various bodies such as Antashka and probably cycling bodies as well. And then next week will be for the objectors.
Okay, well, we'll check in with you again, Anne. Thanks a million for talking to us this morning. Anne Lucy joining us live there from County Kerry.
Minister for Finance Pascal Donoghue set the scene at the outset of his Doyle speech yesterday. A budget without precedent for a time without precedent. Welfare rates frozen, significant tax changes put on the back burner, a Brexit package and the well-flagged increase in carbon taxes. The minimal response necessary to the growing clamour for action on climate change. We're joined from our Doyle studio this morning by the Minister for Communications, Climate Action and Environment, Richard Bruton. A very good morning to you, Minister. Thanks for coming in to talk to us this morning.
Hi, Brian.
Perhaps before we talk about Budget 2020, I might ask you about what's happening in relation to Brexit. It does seem after the exchanges yesterday that we're closer now to a breakdown than a breakthrough. The Taoiseach isn't hopeful, it would seem, of a deal by next week's EU summit. Are we heading now either for a deferral of Brexit on October 31st or a no-deal cliff edge, do you think?
Well, I don't think anyone would predict exactly where this will go. I think both Simon Coveney and Leo Varadkar, I think, have been calm and resolute throughout this. They are saying a deal is still possible, but they are indicating that there's very significant gulfs on the issue of customs, in other words, border checks, and the issue of Stormont one party having a veto effectively on Northern Ireland remaining aligned in regulation with the South. The added difficulty, of course, is the very diverse voices in the UK as they seem to be positioning themselves for a general election. So these are not ingredients that make it easy, but I think we are continuing to work at it. But it also underlines how right Pascal Donoghue was 6 months ago to say this budget must be built around the challenge of a hard exit.
And I want to come to that, but just in terms of the practicalities of this, is there enough time remaining for some resolution even on those basic terms?
Well, clearly, if we were getting closer to resolving those two issues, anything is possible. I mean, we've seen European Union on previous occasions go into, as they call it, the tunnel and come up with documentation and text at a very late moment. But the gulf is very significantly wide. And as the Taoiseach pointed out last night, this represents a very significant step back from where the Theresa May deal was, where it sought to resolve the crux issues. So there is a long way to go. And I think, you know, we just have to keep working every day we can to bring forward a solution. But at the end of the day, we also have to prepare for things going significantly wrong. And we've done immense amount of work anticipating that and preparing for that already.
In relation specifically then to that budget package of 1.2 billion for Brexit, it is the case, is it not, that at best that might mitigate the effects of a no-deal Brexit. It's not going to be able to insulate us from the consequences.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, there is no way if we faced, you know, WTO tariffs on agricultural produce, saw the sort of problems that could emerge in the fishing area, you know, the impact on beef, the impact on tourism. These are all very significant. So as you say, these are about putting in place measures that could help businesses restructure in the face of very difficult challenges. But it's really important that we are prepared, we have those programmes designed, and we are in a position to implement them and to help people deal with the challenges from day one. So there will be a very intense preparation for day one, week one, month one, but also these significant supports for restructuring businesses that will be impacted, and indeed workers who could be impacted by this.
Coming to some of the specifics, and particularly those which fall within your own responsibility, the carbon tax increase announced yesterday, €6 per tonne. John Fitzgerald, chairman of the Climate Advisory Council, has said that that increase is disappointing. And I suppose the question he asks and others ask is, how will, well, what might be €1 extra on the fill at the pumps for your car actually change or even begin to change behaviour?
Well, I think the first thing is to step back and say this is the first budget where implementing our climate action policy is front and centre. And there is a lot more besides the carbon price. For example, we will be providing an auction to increase our renewable power by 60% in an auction that will be held start before the end of this year. But turning to the carbon price, the signal always was that by 2030 we would have €80 per tonne. But we have chosen to increase this in a way that's steady, not a jolt that will put people who struggle to adjust in a really difficult situation. So it's important that we create the signal that says to people, you must now start thinking of taking carbon out of your lifestyle. And that will take time. It has a steady trajectory to help them. And we're using every cent of the money to help families to make those changes, whether it be the trebling of the budgets for home retrofitting or the doubling of the budgets for electric vehicles and electric charging networks. These are really significant investments for the sort of transition we need to make.
But it's also the case, and I presume you'd accept it, that this kind of measure can only work if people actually have an alternative. And for very many people, for perhaps hundreds of thousands of people, there is no alternative to using their car, to filling it up with petrol or diesel, and to heating their home with home heating oil. They'll just have to stump up the extra, won't they?
No, there are alternatives, and I think that's what the reason why we're trebling, for example, the amount of money for home retrofitting. You can very significantly reduce your energy bill if you change the fabric of your house or change the heating system or look at solar or so on, and there's very significant money for that. You can also, your running costs on an electric vehicle will be one-fifth of what they are on a diesel vehicle. So if people take up the opportunities to switch, they will have lower costs over the longer term.
But that means you've got to go and buy a new car, and not everybody's in a position to do that.
That's correct, and that's why, exactly going back to your first point, we're doing this on a graduated basis so people have the opportunity to plan these things over time. And a family mightn't be able to change their car, but they might consider doing some work on the fabric of their home. So there are different options out there to help people in different situations. And of course, we're doing a really important thing and looking at the Midlands, who's immediately impacted potentially by this exiting of fossil fuels. and we're making sure that the money raised is there to have a package for workers to help restore bogs, retrofit in the Midlands, a just transition fund and so on. These are really important elements as we manage this. We have to support people who are either most exposed or least equipped to deal with it.
But that's an acknowledgement implicitly, isn't it, that the burden falls unfairly as compared to rural or urban areas. People in urban areas have options of public transport. They might have access to gas heating, for example, for their home. People in very many rural parts of this country simply don't have those alternatives available.
Yes, but of course, you know, a budget is a balanced package. So, for example, we are going to roll out the National Broadband Plan, which is entirely targeted at rural Ireland, and it is about helping people in rural Ireland. We have a Project 2040, which is about balanced regional development, and we'll be, over 2 years, we've now increased our infrastructure investment by 34%. That's the roads and the infrastructures that help rural towns and villages to thrive. So, you know, yes, there are, you know, some elements of this budget you can pick out and say, you know, there are families who are in a difficult situation, but we are trying to be offer different interventions that help those families in different ways.
It's just a question of perhaps how far short they fall. €2 in increase in the fuel allowance when, you know, it might cost you an extra €15 to fill your home heating oil tank.
Well, €2 is going to deal with the overall, the annual cost to people on low income. And the fixed €56 increase that's being provided for there is more than the increase in fuel costs for the families affected. So 22% of families will be fully insulated against the impact of the carbon price. But of course, for the other families, they have to look at these other alternatives. But, you know, I think you'll see that the budget helped in other ways with the cost of living. You know, it had programs for childcare, for child poverty, for, you know, healthcare for the under eights, the under sixes with dental, school meals, medical cards for the over 70s, prescription charges, fuel allowance, living alone allowance. So we are trying to identify pinch points where people are particularly affected and ease the burden, even in a budget where we have to focus on those two big challenges of Brexit and climate.
But in terms of social provision, no general increase in weekly social welfare payments, not even, Minister, to keep pace with inflation. And that means that very many social welfare recipients, pensioners, job seekers, carers, they'll in effect be worse off next year, won't they? Because the department's own figures suggest that the cost of living is going to rise.
Yeah, but the reality is that if we don't put ourselves into a position to deal with the challenge of Brexit and to get over this and not see this turn into a real challenge for our economy, we would have failed those pensioners who depend on the state. So we do have to, you know, take stock and make sure we are in a position to deal with this huge challenge that is going to impact upon us.
But just to keep
the balance, we have to strike.
Just to keep pace with inflation, even just to do that. So people at least can maintain their current standard of living. Couldn't do that.
Well, we did, of course, provide, you know, €5 a week on the for pensioners who are living alone. We are providing €2 a week for those who are on fuel scheme. We're helping with the prescription charges. So we're looking at elements that impact on retired people who don't have options. But we do have to say to everyone that this is a time when we have to focus on this massive challenge. We believe we will get through with the measures Pascal has put in place yesterday. We can get through this without seeing what you'd call a recession in the economy. So this is going to be much lower growth, less money flowing around in the economy next year than we expected, but still it will have positive expansion. We're just putting €3 billion back into the economy next year. You know, this is not a cutback or a haircut budget by
means. It's still a budget that depends to a great or significant extent on, if I may describe them, as windfall taxes from the corporate sector. And we know there have been constant warnings, including from within the department itself, that if there was any shock to Ireland's corporate tax base, these are the big multinationals, €6 billion could appear as a hole in our public finances. We're still using those revenues to fund day-to-day spending, aren't we?
Yeah, corporate tax raises about one sixth of our overall tax revenue, and I think we have been careful. This year we will be running a surplus, so we are in a position to manage that. But I think if Pascal Dunne was turning around and I was having to defend a situation that we hadn't invested in new schools, hadn't invested in the housing crisis that we face, hadn't started to build hospitals that we need, you would be asking me other questions about is our society in such a bedraggled state that it can't face the challenges. Pascal made the right choice, in my view, in putting investment in public infrastructures at the core of the last number of budgets, so that we have decent social structures to respond to these changes. I'm not saying we fix those problems, but we are on the way to curing a lot of those problems after a lost decade.
Minister for Communications, Climate Action and the Environment, Richard Bruton, thank you for talking to us on Morning Ireland this morning.
Last week, the Tidy Towns competition winners were announced to great excitement across the country in hundreds of villages, small and large towns and urban centres. However, for six towns, there was disappointment. They weren't even listed despite entering. Adjudicators will now hit the road again after what's been described as a computer glitch omitted the six applications from Greystones and Bray in County Wicklow, Glenroe and Ballyorgan in County Limerick and Mount Rath in County Laois. We can speak now to the chairperson of the Tidy Towns Committee in Greystones, Marie McCooey. Marie, you're welcome to the programme. Thanks for joining us. So, obviously,
you
must be very disappointed after what happened last week.
We are very disappointed. We're still waiting, obviously, to get our results, so we don't know. Yes, we are very disappointed. All we can do is wait and hope.
And you didn't realise that there was a computer glitch because you were waiting to see, to watch online for the results to appear last week, and then there was no sign of Greystones in the results and you were a bit surprised.
That's exactly it. At the beginning of September, the invitations come out to the award ceremony at the end of September. And we were expecting an invitation because we got our first bronze medal last year. And we had done a good year this year, we had a good report, and we expected, hoping as hope, we would be invited again. So we didn't get the invitation. We were kind of just a bit down. Okay, bummer. Let's just see where we went wrong. So then you're waiting on the 30th of September until 1 o'clock in the middle of the day when the results will be released. And I'm sitting there at the computer, get online, and I see, oh my goodness, there's no sign of Greystones. And then I looked at my neighbour, oh, there's no sign of Bray. So we were kind of like, wow, what's going on here? So it was straight away on to the Tidy Towns Committee. And next day we got told that they didn't receive our entry.
And so what happens now?
Now we're waiting for them. I don't know whether they've come out again and judged. Now we're waiting for them to, they have now got our report. So we're waiting for the judges to come out to review our town. They may have come at this stage. I understood that they were coming out over the next few days. And then our report is going to get written and we will be notified of our result.
And I suppose the important thing is, Marie, because at this time of the year now, the hanging baskets, are they starting to wilt a little bit? Are you worried that the Greystones isn't looking as good as it might have been?
Oh, Greystones always look great. It always looks great. But no, they have said that they are going to take that into account, that it's not just about the hanging baskets. We did a lot in relation to wildflowers and verges this year. They're obviously gone over. So they've said they will take that into account.
Well, we hope that you and the other tens then do get something and that Greystones holds on to your bronze medal. Marie McCooey, Chairperson of the Tidy Towns Committee in Greystones, thank you for joining us. And I should say that the Department of Community and Rural Affairs does say that as a result of the adjudications, if a medal is awarded to any of the towns affected, it won't displace any existing medal winners that have already been announced.
Thousands of people have been leaving their homes in northern Syria as Turkey continues its assault on border towns. The attacks began after President Trump pulled US soldiers out of the area. Last night, he said he hoped to mediate in the conflict. The areas under attack are controlled by Kurdish militias, key allies of the United States in the battle against Islamic State. They say they've been stabbed in the back. Lindsay Hilsum, the international editor of Channel 4 News, is in the Kurdish Syrian town of Qamishli.
Well, as far as I'm aware, here in Qamishli, it has been a reasonably quiet night. There was more shelling last night, the night before, than last night. But people have been fleeing from the border area There are several villages which are now occupied by forces which are proxies for the Turks, Arab forces which are proxies for the Turks. And I think that there's a lot of fear for today and more people fleeing their homes in the border area.
And when people leave their homes, where can they go?
Well, the Kurdish held area is reasonably large. There's a place called Hasaka further south, which is far away from the border, and that at the moment seems to be where people are fleeing to, and people are going to stay with relatives and so on. But of course the question is what's going to happen in the long term, because if the Turks are determined to create a buffer zone and to move in Syrian refugees, Arabs who are currently in Turkey, then we're talking about people being permanently displaced. And it's quite different going to stay with your auntie in Hasaka for a couple of weeks than, you know, losing your home forever.
Can we talk a little more about that? Turkey has a huge army. What's its stated aim?
What President Erdogan of Turkey has said is that the Kurdish forces on this side of the border are terrorists and that this is an operation to get rid of terrorists. Well, the Kurds who control this part of Syria they have formed a military group called the Syrian Democratic Forces, who fought alongside the Americans and with the British to defeat the Islamic State. So certainly the Americans and British would not think of them as terrorists. However, they are connected with the PKK, which is a force inside Turkey, a Kurdish force, which the Turks regard as terrorists. They want to separate from the Turkish state, and Western countries do also regard them as terrorists. So that's the connection. Now, what the aim of the Turks is to separate the Kurds in Turkey from the Kurds in Syria. So if they create this buffer zone, and if they force, and it will be forcing refugees from Syria, many Arabs, into that area, then what they've done is they have effectively separated the Kurds of Turkey, some of whom are loyal to the PKK, the group that wants to overthrow or wants to separate out from the Turkish government, from the Kurds of Syria. And that is their aim.
And over the past couple of days then, have the Kurds been fighting back?
They have been fighting back, and there have been losses on both sides. But the SDF, the Kurdish, and I should say there are some Arabs within that force as well, but the mainly Kurdish forces here, they just don't have the military strength to fight a NATO member army like the Turks. They don't have, you know, the massive tanks and so on. They don't have air power. In fact, when they were fighting the Islamic State, they were the ground forces. They were what you might call the poor bloody infantry, and it was the Americans who provided the air power, who bombed the Islamic State. So they just do not have the ability to fight back against the Turks. And I'm told that in the two main towns that the Turks have been targeting, Tal Abyad and Ras Al Ain, my understanding is that the Kurdish forces have retreated.
President Erdogan has been giving short shrift to those who criticise what he's doing, saying that the EU has paid Turkey to look after a huge number of Syrian refugees.
Well, of course, that's where he has a point, isn't it? There are 3.6 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. Turkey has shouldered an enormous burden of looking after these refugees. It's a very large number. However, I think that President Erdogan, he knows that what he's doing, because he said so, is to fight the Kurds. His main issue is his own Kurdish problem, as he sees it, within Turkey. And when President Trump announced that he was withdrawing the very few American forces here on the Syrian side of the border, President Erdogan saw it as a green light. He saw that as his moment. Pounds. There was no threat from this side of the border to Turkey, no threat at all. And yet President Erdogan moved to attack the Kurds on the Syrian side of the border because he saw the opportunity. He knew that there would be a lot of criticism from Europe, but what President Trump did, it gave him the green light.
How real are the fears that all of this will give ISIS prisoners an opportunity to escape?
Oh, I think the fear is very real. I was here in March and visited Al Hol camp, which is one of the camps where women who are still loyal to the Islamic State are held. And the Kurdish forces there, they hold order there by a very, very thin thread, because those women are still determinedly devoted to the Islamic State. There have been stabbings, there have been uprisings and riots against the Kurdish guards. Now, what the Kurds are saying is that they cannot hold on to those camps, because there are several camps and also prisons, because they have to send their people to the border to fight. Well, maybe that's a little bit of what one might call threat or blackmail, because apparently they are still looking after those prisoners. They are still guarding those camps, because of course they don't want these Islamic State prisoners running around the Kurdish-held part of Syria. The last thing they want is for them to regroup and start forming their caliphate again. That's what they spent the last 4 years fighting. But there is, you know, there is very little security there. And then the question is, many of those camps are further into to Syrian the Kurdish-held Syria than the buffer zone that the Turks are talking about. And so it makes the whole situation very insecure. And some of the Americans are still here, and there are some British special forces as well. But this is a very, very unstable situation. And this is something which affects, you know, all of Syria and Europe as well, because if these people start to escape, well, some of them are a threat. And their leader, Baghdadi, called upon them to escape and to go back to their own countries and to start, terrorist attacks there. So this is a threat to everybody.
And that was Lindsay Hilsum, international editor of Channel 4 News, speaking earlier from northern Syria. By the way, the French European Affairs Minister has said this morning that sanctions against Turkey will be on the table at next week's European summit. A week of protests in Dublin city centre starts today, organised by the environmental group Extinction Rebellion. It's part of what's called Rebellion Week, protests in up to 50 other countries. Susan Breen from the group is here now. Good morning and welcome. What's planned? What can you tell us?
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. What's planned is a lot of different events. There's been a lot of kind of sensationalist scaremongering in the press. I saw today in the Daily Mail we were referred to as extremists, which is certainly news to me. There will be some disruption, but it will be focused on government and industry rather than the general public, because that's not who we have issue with at all. And other than that, we will have a load of kind of outreach, family kind of events, regenerative culture events, and a lot of just really nice community building events going on.
So you mentioned the scaremongering. Who are you then? Tell us about why you joined Extinction Rebellion.
Well, I joined because I'm a mother of young children, and I've been involved in the environmental movement for years. And like so many of us, you know, we've sent petitions, we've marched in the streets, we've done everything, and we feel we've exhausted every possible means of making the government listen to us. And I'm terrified. I've got young children and they're heading into an absolutely precarious future. And I don't feel that the people who can actually do something about it have any interest in doing that. And that's why we're in this situation where we're putting ourselves in the firing line, risking arrest, doing things that we would never have thought of doing before, because we're just desperate to be heard. And like I said, none of us want to be causing disruption.
Well, like what? I mean, what will you be doing? What will you be putting yourselves in the face of, in the line of, risking arrest?
We will be trying to highlight what we see as climate crimes and the people that are perpetrating them. That's the main thing that we'll
like
be trying
who?
To
I mean,
do.
Who are you talking about? What crimes?
Government and industry. I won't give away any names.
No. But aren't we all guilty of not doing enough? I mean, that accusation can probably be levelled at most of us.
Well, I mean, the power of one is very important. But I mean, when you consider that 100 companies are responsible for 71% of the global emissions since 1988, that just puts it into perspective. I mean, anything that we, you know, actually add to it is just a drop in the ocean compared to what's being brought on by the industries and by government allowing it to happen.
What do you say, though, to those involved in business in the city centre, for example, who say, you know,
we support the aims of what you're doing, but not the methods. And you risk getting people's backs up by disrupting, causing extreme disruption to their day.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, we won't be trying to cause major disruption to normal people. That's absolutely not our aim at all. If that happens, we apologise. We absolutely apologise. And if anybody feels that they know a better way of making the government listen, or they have terrible issues with what we're doing, please come down and talk to us. They'll know where our camp is very soon. And we will have that conversation. And if they have other ways that they think would be better, please come and talk to us about it. We would love to know.
Can you assure people over the next week that there won't be any trouble, that you as organisers will simply not tolerate anyone hijacking your protests?
Absolutely. We are absolutely non-violent, absolutely peaceful. And that's what our foundation is. You know, a lot of our members will be bringing their children along. It's absolutely a family movement. There is absolutely no violence. There's no drink or drugs allowed, absolutely none. So, yeah, we can guarantee that that is not accepted at all by Extinction Rebellion.
What are you trying to get government to do? Because you'll be aware of their climate action plan. The budget is tomorrow. There's talk that there may be an increase in the carbon tax by 6-7 euro a ton. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you think of that, for first of all?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you're taxing, doesn't it? You know, if you're taxing someone who can't afford to heat their home, that's not very progressive. If you're taxing industry that is absolutely poisoning the planet and making billions, then absolutely they should be taxed. So it depends on the method of taxation, as far as I'm concerned. In terms of the government's plans, again, you know, action speaks louder than words. If they're willing to fast track Shannon LNG or block the climate measures emergency measures bill, or still hand out drilling licenses, then it doesn't look like they really care about climate breakdown to me.
OK, what do you hope to have achieved, though, by the end of this week?
By the end of this week, I hope to have had some very positive interactions with the general public, and to have more people come down to our campsite, you know, hear our talks, you know, kind of spread more educational messages, and also highlight people who are doing terrible damage to the climate and taking very little responsibility to it.
OK, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks,
Susan Breen from Extinction Rebellion.
Now, do you know what the air pressure in your tyres should be? How often do you check the safety of your tyres? Today is Tyre Safety Day, and Maggie Doyle has been speaking to some drivers at a garage forecourt in Dublin this morning to see how their tyres are.
Well, it was only NCT a couple of weeks ago, so I think it's all up to scratch.
And how often would you check your tyres? Would you wait for the NCT to come?
No. If soon as it didn't get low, I'd always run my finger along where they tell you they're low, you know.
And so how often would that be?
Well, it depends how often I drive the car. So, probably every 7 months.
Did you know that you should be checking them once a month?
I didn't know.
I only got new ones, so it's fine.
When did you get the new ones?
For the NCT there, about 3 months ago.
Would you normally check your tyres?
No. To be truthful with you, I didn't. And when I went up to get the tyres done, he said one of them was totally bald. Yeah.
And were you shocked by that?
Yeah, very shocked. But you see, I don't have a clue about it. I drive the car all right, but the tyre was bald, so I got the whole lot done.
Did you know that you have to check them once a month?
How do you check them? See, I don't even... You know, I'm just on my own, so I don't know much about cars or that. I had to bring it to the garage. It cost me a fortune all the time.
Usually I keep them kind of up to date.
How often would you be checking them?
Not that often, maybe every couple of months. No, I usually come here, actually. Sometimes the mechanic, if there's a job needs to be done on the car.
So today the guards will be checking, and also the Road Safety Authority will be
out and about
checking tyres.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a good idea?
I think it's a very good idea, yeah. And also the threads on the tyres, because a lot of them are bald, particularly going to cold weather, you know.
And would you know how to check the tread on your tyres as well?
I've never been taught how to check the tread, just other by looking at it and kind of knowing it. But my mechanic's quite good that way in terms of how long I'll get out of the tyres, you know.
And those road users speaking to Maggie Doyle this morning. As Maggie mentioned, Gardaí will be spot checking tyres on cars, trucks and buses. Faulty tyres could cost you 4 penalty points and a fine, but there are plenty of tyre sellers who will check your tyres for free today, including Fergal Eve, who's a spokesperson for the Irish Tyre Industry Association. Fergal, thanks for coming into us this morning.
Good morning.
When you're checking tyres, what are you looking for?
Well, there are tread wear indicators on every tyre, and they are dispersed around the tyre 4 or 5 times. So if you run your finger around and your tread wear indicator is level with the tread on the tyre, then that's your 1.6 measurement. But tyres, people shouldn't wait until that time to check their tyres. They should be checking them first and foremost for pressure at least once a month, because tyres do lose pressure. And even if you have a tyre pressure monitor,
yes,
you should still check your tyres, because you will, if you don't check them, you will have uneven wear, you will have premature wear, and also you will be losing the economy in your car as well.
There's plenty of cars now that will tell you that your tyre pressure is off, but that's not always very reliable. How can you do it yourself?
Well, you just check it at a filling station, or come into your local ITIA member, who are professional tyre people, and they will check it for you free of charge, not only this week, but any week you want.
And if you want to check it yourself, or you feel that it might be off, how do you know what the exact tyre pressure should be in your car?
Well, the pressures are on the body of the car. There's a badge on the body of the car somewhere, maybe on the inside of the door, or it could be on the filler cap, or in the case of small Toyotas, it's actually in the glove compartment. The sticker is there.
And how often should you be checking them?
Well, you should be checking them by right at least about once a month, to be sure. If you want to get the full value out of your tyres, and you don't want to be visiting me too often, you keep an eye on your pressures.
The tyre checks that you do, are they always free? I mean, I know they're free today and we're encouraging people to go today, but are they always free?
Yeah, I mean, any ITI dealer will certainly check your tyres anytime, whenever. Feel free to pop into them. They're ITIA, www.itia.ie.
The Road Safety Authority is saying that on average there are 14 deaths a year that can be attributed to faulty tyres, and there are several accidents as well that are caused by faulty tyres. Remind us, how do bad tyres or lack of pressure or bad tread depth lead to accidents?
So unfortunately, all those things, they all lead to accidents. And when the problem is that when we need to stop in a hurry, and especially with the amount of rain that we have here, all motorists need to keep an eye on their tyres. It's the only part of the car that's in contact with the road. And it's very, very important that they have the correct tyres, they have the correct sizes, load capacities and all the rest. And a professional, any ITIA professional tyre dealer will be able to fill them in on all the information.
One of the main reasons that people are reluctant to check their tyres with you or with anyone else is the cost of replacing them. And what should people expect to replace tyres on their car?
Well, that varies quite considerably, I can assure you of that. But, I mean, what cost do you put on lives?
Roughly, though.
Well, look, it's very hard to be roughly. I mean, I suppose you're talking about an average of around €100 a corner and upwards, because it depends, obviously, on the vehicle.
Fergal, no, thanks very much for coming in. That's Fergal Leaf, who's a spokesperson for the Irish Tyre Industry Association.
Forget Brexit, forget the budget, forget Donald Trump. There was one subject dominating social media yesterday. On Twitter, it quickly became known as Wagatha Christie. And for this morning's papers, it has provided a bonanza of puns from Waggy Leaks to Wagro. The story at the centre of this, a claim by one English footballer's wife, or WAG, Colleen Rooney, that someone using the Instagram account of another footballer's wife, Rebecca Vardy, had been leaking stories about her to The Sun. On Britain's Channel 4 News last night, they recreated the social media post in which Mrs. Rooney revealed her sting.
For a few years now, someone who I trusted to follow me on my personal Instagram account has been consistently informing the Sun newspaper of my private posts and stories. I've saved and screenshotted all the original stories, which clearly show just one person has viewed them. It's Rebecca Vardy's account.
And here's a short excerpt from Rebecca Vardy's response.
I'm so upset that you have chosen to do this, especially when I'm heavily pregnant. I'm disgusted that I'm even having to deny this.
RTE multimedia journalist Sinead Brennan is here. Sinead, Colleen Rooney, she's quite the detective, hence the Wagatha Christie moniker. What did she do?
So apparently she put in 5 months of investigative time into figuring out who it was that was leaking these stories about her. So I don't know how many accounts she tried out with this method she went down, but she blocked everyone else apart from Rebecca Vardy's account and then took screenshots to show that only that account had seen these stories that she had made up.
Now, the stories, I mean, they were hardly earth-shattering, but they were all in the newspapers, or in The Sun, rather, in particular.
Yeah, so there was one about her basement leaking, there was one about a supposed return to television, and one about her going to Mexico for a gender program thing. I'm not actually 100% sure what that one was.
Presumably, I think it was to do with that she might try and choose the gender.
That was it, yeah.
If she was having another child, because I think she has, what is it, 4 sons.
Yeah.
So Rebecca Vardy, Colleen Rooney put this up on her Instagram and her Twitter yesterday, that she had uncovered what was going on. Rebecca Vardy responded pretty quickly.
She did, to try to clear her name and say like she had no part in this whatsoever. She revealed that she'd already spoken to Colleen about it on the phone, and she was saying, you know, you shouldn't have put this out there privately. I mean, publicly, when we've already spoken about it privately. And she was saying that, you know, she's heavily pregnant, she doesn't need the stress, she doesn't need the money, so why would she have done it? And apparently she has now hired forensic investigators to get to the bottom of if someone could have hacked her account.
Forensic investigators. Then the deluge started. The sheer volume of comments, a lot of them, it has to be said, very witty on Twitter yesterday, was quite something.
I think Twitter is made for days like yesterday. It just shows how funny people can be. And it's really the break everyone needed from Brexit. So it was good to focus everyone else's attention on something a little bit lighter, because it is pure kind of soap opera gossip, but in real life. So people couldn't believe it. Like, even Netflix got involved. One of their tweets was my favourite. It was, we're going to have to make a documentary about this, aren't we? And people were, you know, pulling up other stories about Wayne and Colleen Rooney and saying, you know, is this true, or were they just having Rebecca Vardy on? And these kinds of things. There was a lot of like visual memes too that were fantastic. But I thought another great one was her Wikipedia page was very quickly updated to call her an amateur detective.
And that there's so much stuff in the papers this morning. And I suppose what we have really here is a perfect combination of celebrity, of old media, so-called, in the form of The Sun, and of new media, because really this all comes back down to Colleen Rooney's Instagram account.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll just be interested to see how it all goes out. I think everyone's going to be following this story because, like you said, there is so many factors at play. But it just came so out of the blue as well. And I think the way she even wrote her thing describing what had gone on was so well done. It had like a twist and their big reveal, and it really just, you know, you were reading through wondering what was going to happen.
Well, this is it. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying, as we've been saying, that Colleen Rooney should be a detective, but you'd have to think that there's a bit of a writer in her as well, because she wrote that Instagram post. It was, as you say, it was like a short story with a reveal in the final two words.
That's it. It was absolutely brilliant. It was just so good and so out of the blue. I think, you know, it's just a story that we'll all be following a lot.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, Sinead.
You've been listening to a selection of stories from this week's Morning Ireland.